I know it's hard to gauge because there's a lot of South Asians and a lot of people of Indian origin in Canada. But what's been the reaction to Modi's election in Canada's Indian diaspora?
Well, from what I've heard and from, you know, people I've talked to, I mean, there was, for example, in the Park X neighborhood in an Indian restaurant, the Saturday after the election results came out, apparently sweets were being distributed. So, you know, a section of the community that was very happy with the election results. I don't quite know whether they were happy because Modi got elected or the Congress was out, but there was this sense of rejoicing which mirrored what was going on in India. But with people that I've talked to who are, I guess, more concerned about Modi's background and the Hindutva agenda in India, people are quite tempered in their responses. As you were saying, it's hard to know exactly how the next few years are going to pan out.
But now, when you mentioned Modi's background in Hindutva, could you first explain what Hindutva is and then what background you're talking about?
Yeah, so he has been chief minister of the state of Gujarat in India. And in 2002, there was a genocide against Muslims in Gujarat where over 2,000 people were killed, and all the evidence of all kinds of reports from Indian as well as foreign human rights organizations pointing the finger to Modi. Now, Modi himself,
pointing to him that he allowed that to happen or actually did it?
Yes. Well, a couple of things. One is that he did not intervene once the killing began, that when police stations were called, people were told by the police officers there, we have no orders to save you. But other investigations have actually pointed the finger all the way to him as being an architect for what happened. So there's all kinds of evidence linking Modi either directly or not taking action to stop what happened. In terms of Hindutva, Hindutva is a word that is used to describe the making of India into a Hindu nation, and it's part of an ideology of Hindu nationalism that goes back to the early 20th century. And Mr. Modi himself has been, from his childhood almost, a member of various organizations that are linked together. It's a sort of big umbrella of organizations committed to making India a Hindu nation. And he has not been shy about speaking about this aim and objective again and again, until as recently as, you know, the election campaigns that were continuing. For example, when he was in West Bengal, he said that, you know, we're going to stop all the Muslim infiltrators from Bangladesh. And in other places when he has spoken similarly, he said, you know, India is a Hindu nation and we will welcome Hindus from all over the world. But, you know, as far as the Muslims are concerned, you know, we don't want them.
So is that why there's a certain concern within the Canada's Indian diaspora that he is very much oriented to only one part of India's reality?
Yes. So we're kind of looking, those of us who are very concerned in a negative way, with his track record. So even though he and his PR teams have downplayed this background and as far as the Indian elections have gone, have tried to focus on development, because that's the other part of his platform, that he has been really successful in his state of Gujarat in, you know, bolstering the economy, making it so vibrant. I mean, the slogan is Vibrant Gujarat, that all kinds of domestic and foreign investors have come in, and the state government in Gujarat has been very effective in getting them, you know, facilities to build factories, in all kinds of infrastructure has been provided. And the message during this election has been, this Gujarat model will be applied to the rest of India. So the rest of India will be able to develop economically like Gujarat. And that's something that's very seductive to a lot of people, particularly a younger electorate. This is a first election where many young Indians have been able to vote for the first time, and they've provided a new demographic. And when I was looking at election statistics, say the last general election in India was 2009, the participation rate has jumped by about 8%. And talking to other friends, we've kind of thought that this jump reflects this new generation that's now able to vote. Many of them are definitely, you know, for justifiable reasons, concerned about jobs and making a decent living in this globalized world. And, you know, price rises have gone up in India. So the Gujarat model across India has been very appealing. And so those of us who have these fears about Modi and Hindutva are sometimes drowned out as, you know, sort of just these naysayers who just won't give up.
Will these young voters, would they be aware of or not care about what happened in 2002 in Gujarat?
I think there is a lack of knowledge and information. And this is something, you know, partly because I'm a historian and I teach history also to young people here in Montreal in Canada, I find that there are huge gaps in historical knowledge. And it's quite alarming when I see that these gaps actually result in people not making informed decisions, for example, when elections come up, or not even caring about politics, just sort of concentrating on their wallets and jobs and careers and professions. They've kind of, the decline of a humanistic education around the world is very, very alarming, particularly, you know, when the world economies are globalizing and there's, you know, neoliberalism and sort of the bottom line and profitability seems to be the new kind of ethics and morality. So India is not alone in that, because I'm used to talking to young people here, teaching young people, and they're very receptive. So it's not that they don't want to know, it's just that the opportunities are not provided. So coming back to what you were saying about young people in India, I don't think so. And if they know, and over here I feel the Canadian media is also very, very lazy and slipshod and culpable. When they talk about Gujarat in 2002, they might say, well, you know, but there are questions being raised about Gujarat in 2002 when there was a riot between Hindus and Muslims. And it makes it sound almost like some primordial antagonism between Hindus and Muslims. And it presents it almost like it balances out, you know, Hindus killed Muslims, Muslims killed Hindus. And the aspect that it was a genocide, it was planned, it was very one-sided. There might have been some Hindus who were also attacked, but the vast majority and the planning points to an attack on Muslims. So not knowing the history or just knowing a little bit about it means that you're not as aware to the potential dangers.
You mentioned the Canadian media, and in terms of since his election and looking at the Canadian media, there might be a mention of the Gujarat riots.
Yes.
But mostly the emphasis is that here is this prime minister who's business friendly, who had success in the state of Gujarat in terms of the economy there. Would you say it's fair that if anybody knows anything in the Canadian mainstream about Modi, that would be what they know about?
Well, in the mainstream, I think in the last few weeks or the last couple of months, yes, the Gujarat model there might of development, economic development. And I think there would be some mention about the violence in Gujarat, but that's how it would be posed, violence or riots, which is very far from the truth. And I guess, to be fair, I mean, most people around the world, as I was just saying, are interested in economic growth, economic opportunities, and India poses a potentially very, very great economic opportunity. So,
And Canada has been one of the countries courting India, trying to come up with a free trade deal.
Yes.
Is there a perception, because this emphasis on Modi being business friendly almost suggests as if the Congress party that's been in power is not business friendly, and yet there were discussions.
Yeah, no. And even in Canada, you know, because I've been following particularly the links between India, but particularly Gujarat, India and Canada since the genocide of 2002. One of the things that I found really shocking was that in 2002, just after the genocide occurred, there was a trade delegation that went from, you know, Team Canada. This was when Jean Chrétien was was
and the Prime Minister Jean Chrétien,
Liberal government. Mm-hmm. More recently, of course, under the government of Stephen Harper, Canada has opened a trade office in Gujarat. Now, whether one could say it's a kind of ideological sort of conservative government with another conservative government, but I think trade trounces anything. And I've actually done, you know, studies and written. There's a book that's coming out in July, and I have a chapter there on Gujarat. And I look at the question of human rights and trade, and disappointingly and discouragingly, trade opportunities always trounce human rights. So Canada's interests, I mean, Canada needs India economically much more than India needs Canada, is, you know, so the interest, business interests in Canada and the political establishment reflects the business interests in Canada, would just go ahead with doing whatever is necessary to take that agenda, that economic agenda forward.
So now with Modi as Prime Minister, countries like the United States and Canada, where there was always controversy about whether Modi should be allowed to come into the country, it becomes easier to say, well, he's the prime minister, so he should be allowed to come into the country.
Yes.
And we should have relations with him. We can't ignore this large market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. There are various aspects to it. I know that even when some of us were involved in the U.S. or in Britain or in Canada in working with, you know, American, British, or Canadian governments to deny Mr. Modi a visa on the grounds of human rights abuses and holding a country like Canada up to its standards and who it gives visas to, there were people, I would say progressive people in the activist community, who actually opposed this because they said nobody should encourage governments to deny visas because they do that regularly anyway. But now in the current situation, I think the man, as we're speaking, he's probably being sworn in as prime minister. He is the head of state. And so as a head of state, whether it's Mr. Modi or Mr. Manmohan Singh or anybody, has to be accorded that right to visit. So, you know, even though it's personally very distasteful for me, the state-to-state relations, you know, you can't get away from that. And so that's a new reality. Of course, Mr. Modi's supporters, who were prevented from physically bringing him in the past, will see this as a triumph, that, you know, you kind of stopped it before, but you couldn't kind of stop it now.
Do you think the election of Narendra Modi as Prime Minister of India is going to change Canada-Indian relations?
I don't know. It's always very difficult to look into the future. I know there are, you know, approximately 1 million people of Indian origin in Canada. There's a sizable Gujarati community in Canada as well. So I think it will probably be a continuum of what was started. So, you know, you were mentioning this free trade agreement, which is in its final stages. I don't think it's going to be held up or shot down. I think it will continue. I don't know.
Well, there are even some Indo-Canadian business organizations saying that it will be fast forwarded now.
Yes. So it could be fast forwarded. There might be even greater opportunities created. It's hard for me to say, but yes, with the focus on business much more so in a very overt way, it's possible that the business linkages will increase, you know. And we also have Indian multinationals in Canada. For example, the Tatas are in Quebec, for example, so there might
in the province of Quebec,
there might be more of that traffic as well.
Is that aspect of Hindutva and emphasis on the Hindu reality of India present in the Indian diaspora here in Canada?
Unfortunately, having worked on this issue for so long, I have to, you know, say very sadly, yes. And it ties in also to, first of all, there's this global context of post 9/11 Islamophobia. So there's that reality. And in Canada, we see this regularly with Canadian government rules, you know, the recent striking down by the Supreme Court or upholding by the Supreme Court of the security certificate process in Quebec. You know, we had last fall, you know, heated debates where the government wanted to introduce a charter of values which would ban the wearing of visible symbols by public servants, but most of it revolved around the hijab that Muslim women wear. So we have a lot of that in the sort of discourse happening in the public sphere over here. And if you link that to anti-Muslim sentiment in India, some of it goes back to partition and the terrible tragedy of that time and the violence and the sort of, to some extent, knee-jerk blaming of the other side, but many families were directly affected, so one can empathize with it. And a kind of, just below the surface, anti-Muslim sentiment. I mean, having grown up in India, being part of diasporic communities, I'm very, very familiar with this, the kind of jokes or the snide comments and so on. So I think that has been a reality, and it will continue to be a reality over here.
And in Canada, there's a slightly different kind of proportion or division, because the Sikh presence is very much higher here in Canada in terms of the diaspora than it is in India.
Yes.
And we have, is there a relationship with, in terms of Modi and Hindutva vis-a-vis the Sikh presence?
I'm not sure about Modi and the Sikhs. I know, like, going back to 1947, the time of the partition of the subcontinent, emergence of Pakistan and India as an independent nation, a lot of the violence happened in the Punjab area, West and East Punjab, which the Sikhs consider their heartland and to some extent their homeland. And so there was a lot of anti-Muslim sentiment. But looking at the Sikh community after 1984 and the Indian government's attack on the Golden Temple and the diasporic Sikh community, I don't think there's that automatic allegiance now, one could say, with Hindus and with Sikhs. And I think Sikhs over here would be more sensitive now to a kind of religious nationalism that targets minority populations, because they are a minority population in India. And for the first time in the history of the subcontinent in 1984, there was a pogrom against Sikhs. So I think Sikhs here are much more sensitive, and because of, for example, you know, religious reasons, you know, the religious symbols, you know, being in Quebec, attempts to get Sikh youth to not carry the kirpan or the ceremonial dagger or to wear the turban and play soccer. I think there's a greater sensitivity to how religious identity can be used to stigmatize and marginalize. So I'm hopeful that there might be a greater awareness about religious nationalism and how minority populations can be persecuted and can very severely oppressed.
As someone who's originally from India and you know, obviously for decades now part of the Indian diaspora in Canada, do you and others find yourself in a quandary in terms of, on one hand, wanting to defend the country where you come from, and on the other hand, finding yourself obliged to criticize situations like Modi and the 2002 riots?
I think more than the quandary of defending a country but being critical, say, of the new prime minister, it's less a kind, for me personally, it might not be the same for others, it's less a kind of dilemma of protecting a national identity, but struggling much more against racism. And so, for example, maybe I'm bringing things into the conversation that are slightly outside our ambit. But, for example, there is what some of us are calling an honor crimes industry now. You know, so the government of Canada is putting funds out there to combat violence against women, specifically with regard to honor crimes and forced marriage. And many of us are very alarmed at this because it racializes certain communities, it essentializes, it takes attention away from the wider problem of violence against women and sort of seems to say that there are some communities that practice these very barbaric forms of violence against their women. So I'm much more sensitive to that kind of critique. I believe that governments are there to serve the people, and if they do not serve the people and actually work against the people, whether they're governments in Canada or India, they should definitely be criticized, and they should be, this should be pointed out. They should be forced to change and so on. So I don't feel as closely tied to a kind of, sort of patriotic, nationalistic defense of the Indian nation per se, because to me the Indian nation is composed of all kinds of peoples. And similarly with Canada, for example, when was it? A couple of days ago was the centenary of the Komagata Maru. That was a ship that brought migrants from Punjab to the west coast of Canada. They weren't allowed to land. They were turned back because a racist piece of immigration legislation had been passed. More recently, various governments, Canadian governments, have been apologizing for racist historic policies to the Japanese Canadians who were interned during World War II, or the Chinese Canadians because of the head tax. And so there was an apology in 2008 by Prime Minister Harper about the Komagata Maru. And I think this year there was a stamp that was issued. But the current Canadian government has also put in place a temporary foreign worker policy which discourages long-term permanent resident-type immigration and privileges short-term contract workers, which are great for Canadian business but don't give people stability, undermine the Canadian workforce that's already here in terms of jobs, etc. So I find there's a contradiction. You're apologizing about the Komagata Maru not letting people come, but now you're saying, okay, we'll let you come here for 3 or 6 months, we'll take your labor, and then we'll send you back.
And also the government is toughening all kinds of rules in terms of refugees.
Exactly, exactly.
So there's a double discourse there. In terms of the Canada's Indian diaspora again, will Modi's election fuel the kind of potential racism or religious intolerance that is sometimes latent within the community?
Well, again, having been part of the community and having tried to do sort of coalition work at various points in the, say, political history of India, I do know that in the wake of the destruction of the Babri Mosque in 1992, when there was an attempt to kind of get people in the diaspora together on a platform of secularism, there was some positive response, but there were elements in the community who would say, well, what about Hindu pundits in Kashmir who are no longer allowed to live there? And it's like, but wait a minute, we're talking about two different issues. And it's not as clear-cut as what you're saying. The point I'm trying to make here is that there have been latent anti-Muslim tendencies, and I regret to say that I think those voices will be strengthened now. There's a certain triumphalism that will come out, which to me was represented by the distribution of sweets in this Park X neighborhood of Montreal when Modi's election victory was clear. So this triumphalism, I think, will be boosted further. And people who might have been sitting on the fence are not quite supporters of Modi. I mean, there's nothing as successful as success, you know. As human beings, we like being on the winning side. So I think that to some extent will play into an increased support in the diaspora.
Dolores Chu, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Wojtek, for giving me this opportunity to chat with you.